Hello, you're listening to Romeo And, a podcast about masculinity, nice guys, sexism, and what it means to be a man in our society today. I'm your host, Street Saint. So last week's episode, I raised a lot of interesting points that got me thinking. When I spoke about the Transformers movie, I brought up Megan Fox and how we look at her as a kind of sex symbol. So anything she does is seen as an expression of sexuality. And I wanted to revisit this and talk a little bit more about what's at play here. I think conventionally attractive women often get a bad rap in our culture. We look at them as some higher species, as if they have everything figured out, and if they have any difficulty, someone else will come in and fix it for them. I know I've believed this for a long time, and it wasn't until I got older that I realized how wrong I'd been. I joined a support group for people with anxiety disorders a few years ago, and one of the big things I took away from being part of it was that you can never truly know a person just by looking at them. When I joined the group, I came in with my own biases and prejudices. I expected to see a bunch of sad, decrepit people who weren't able to keep their lives together. I was in a pretty bad shape back then. Anyway, when I got there, I met a bunch of smart, attractive, and put-together people who happened to be dealing with varying levels of anxiety. In particular, some of the people in the group talked about how lonely they had felt and how they never felt anyone was interested in them. Meanwhile, I was thinking in my head, how is that possible? They're so attractive and have a good job and seem to be doing fairly well for themselves. It made me realize that just by virtue of being attractive, life's problems don't just suddenly disappear. Just because you're attractive doesn't mean you never have to work hard or struggle. It doesn't mean you never fail. In the case of Megan Fox, a lot of people saw how attractive she was and just immediately assumed she didn't have to work for anything in her life. Bro, have you ever auditioned for a major blockbuster like Transformers? Just being in the room is enough to make you crap your pants. You don't just go in there cold. These thoughts of she never had to work for anything in her life comes from a sense of jealousy or injustice. You know how hard you have to work for certain things, so when you see others who seem to achieve them effortlessly, it can feel unfair. You might feel cheated. But everyone's struggle is different. And if you're going to compare your life or circumstances to someone else's, I hope for your sake you know of a good anxiety support group. We tell ourselves things like, if I were just prettier, or if I just had a little bit more money, or if I lived in a better environment. But this can only lead to negative thoughts. I'm not saying that being more attractive or wealthier or whatever doesn't make achieving certain things easier. It certainly can, but comparing yourself to someone else or wishing you had something you don't doesn't get you anywhere. You just have to recognize the circumstances you're living in and set your goals based on what you have. Because here's the issue that I wanted to bring up. How can you blame attractive women for using their looks to their advantage? I talked about it when I talked about Megan Fox and her character Michaela. It wouldn't make sense for Michaela to ignore the advantage attractiveness grants you. Why handicap yourself when you don't have to? I've had a few friends who are hard of hearing. I, on the other hand, have been blessed with great hearing. That doesn't mean I should put earplugs in whenever I'm around my friends. In fact, that would definitely be more offensive. So why would we criticize Megan Fox or anyone else gifted with good looks for using them to their advantage? I think it's important for us to remember that comparison is an extremely dangerous and slippery slope. If you start to say that one person's life is more difficult than anyone else's, you bring about a culture of shame, guilt, and resentment. Yes, most of my problems are quote-unquote first-world problems. But it doesn't help me at all to ignore them just because someone else is having a more difficult time. When I encourage people to check their privilege, it means to recognize that you do have advantages over other people. And it's important to be mindful of those advantages in order to sort your priorities, regulate your behavior, and be a better ally to others. To check your privilege simply means to respect the struggles other people might be going through. You don't have to give away your life savings every time you see a homeless person, but you shouldn't turn your nose up at them either. They had different life experiences than you did, which brought them to be where they are. If they lived the life that you had and grew up where you did, they probably wouldn't be living on the street. Or maybe they would, but it doesn't mean they don't deserve your respect. There is a fine line here to be straddled, but it is possible to envy someone without resenting them. It's possible to enjoy the privileges you have without disrespecting those who live without them. And it's possible to ask someone to check their privilege without pressuring them to feel guilt or shame. Ultimately, what it comes down to is respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. And if you're a Unitarian Universalist, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm currently reading the book Rising Strong by researcher Brené Brown. If you haven't read any of her work or seen any of her lectures, I can't describe to you how important it is for you to remedy that. Reading her books and seeing her TED Talks has been nothing short of a spiritual experience for me. She has such eye-opening and important things to say about vulnerability and shame, and she's just so damn good at saying it. Brené Brown, go look her up. I'll have links in the show notes. But in her book, in Rising Strong, she mentions this concept that everyone is doing the best they can. In other words, every single person is doing the best they can do with the resources they have available to them. Which means if you meet someone who happens to offend you or treats you unkindly, it's probably nothing personal. They might just be having a bad day, and they're just lashing out about it, and you just happen to be there for them to snap at. We've all been there. Naturally, Brown does a much better job of explaining the concept, so go read the book. But we have a similar concept in my Unitarian Universalist circles. We say, assume good intentions. And this has always been a priority for me to include in any covenants I build with my spiritual community. To assume good intentions means to recognize that no one is out here to make you feel small. If someone insults or offends you, it's more than likely done unintentionally or from a place of ignorance. And that doesn't mean you're obligated to forgive everyone who upsets you. No, that's ridiculous. You're not obligated to forgive everyone who upsets you. And it doesn't mean that you have to educate everyone you meet about their behavior or your triggers. And just because someone is doing the best they can doesn't mean that their best is going to be good enough for you. And that's totally fine. But if that's the case, then you should do what you can to rid that person from your life. Or just place them in a position where their attacks or their words can't reach you or at the very least can't scar you as severely. At least then you're taking an educated and self-respecting approach to dealing with the person rather than just getting into a shouting match or otherwise breaking down emotionally. Everyone has privilege. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone says things they wish they hadn't. It's part of being human. All we can do is our best. All we can do is do our best and be as graceful as we can when we and the people around us fall short. And so if it seems like that really hot woman is getting by just by virtue of being attractive, don't try to bring her down because of it. She's not doing it to piss you off. She's just doing the best that she can. and so should you. This week's story is coming up next here on Romeo Hand. Last month, I talked to Val, a bisexual woman who shared her experience being asked out by guys and then asking out both women and men herself. If you were around for that episode, then you heard Val ask me whether I had been asked out by a woman before. I said that I had, and that it was awful. And in my discussion of Val's story, I told you guys that I would share that experience with you. Well, if I'm anything, I am a man of my word, so today I'm going to share with you the story of me getting approached by a woman. I was in middle school at the time, but as you know as a listener of this podcast, I had plenty of relationship failures leading up to my high school years, and so I was already feeling pretty ambivalent about women. But I reveal all of that in the story, so I'll just start telling it. Of course, if you want to read along with me or just do it on your own time. The full text of the story is available on my website, stsaint.com/podcast. Just click on Season 2, Episode 11, and you should find the full text of the story. You have to be logged in to read the whole thing, but registration is quick, easy, and totally free. But without further ado, the story is called Be Careful What You Wish For, Lest It Be Tula. I was one of the few black kids in my suburban Connecticut middle school. This came with a certain amount of perks. No one ever forgot my name, since I was never lost in a crowd. Which one is Eric again? Oh right, the black kid. People would compliment my smile because the contrast between my dark skin and white teeth is so stark. And anytime I used proper grammar or formed complete sentences, people would compliment me for being articulate. Being the token black kid meant that I was the sole ambassador to my race at school. I didn't mind it so much because I was different from the black kids we were used to seeing on TV. I didn't use slang or ebonics. I wasn't loud or disruptive. I didn't dance or listen to rap music. And I embraced this about myself. Every time I disproved a black stereotype, it brought me some level of joy. I felt I was doing my race proud, that I was teaching these white folks that black people aren't always the gangsters and thugs they saw on TV. But sometimes being an ambassador to all black people was a drag. It was a lot of pressure, and sometimes I just wanted to be like all my white friends. I couldn't help but feel as though I was still an outsider. Overall, I did my best to ignore the fact that I was different from my peers, and my peers did the same. It was like the don't ask, don't tell policy, but for race. I didn't bring up the fact that I was black, and no one talked to me about it. As far as I could tell, it was the best situation I could ask for. But one area where I couldn't help but think my race was a big factor was dating. Having been raised around white girls, I found them to be most attractive to me. Which was a good thing, all things considered, since I really didn't have many other options when looking for a relationship. However, I couldn't help but wonder how the girls at my school felt about me. I was raised around people of a different race than my own, but all the girls I knew were raised around white boys. In the back of my mind, I knew that I couldn't really compete with that. Would any girl in my school find a black kid like me attractive? Am I just completely out of luck? I couldn't say for sure, but every time I was rejected by a girl I had a crush on, the nagging question of, is it because I'm black? Repeated itself in the back of my mind. But I figured, regardless of the answer, there was nothing I could really do about it. I just had to hope that I would eventually find a girl who was more open-minded about dating outside her race. And when I least expected it, that day came. Unfortunately, I was completely unprepared. By the end of my time in middle school, I was pretty jaded about women and dating. The phrase nice guy was still relatively unknown at the time, and the term friend zone had not yet been coined, so I didn't really have the words to express how I felt about my life. But I did observe that the women I knew tended to avoid the polite and sensitive guys and instead date the bad boys. It felt extremely unfair to me that nice guys like me were so infrequently rewarded with love. I wished that women were allowed to approach and ask out men. If the girls who actually did appreciate me and found me attractive could make themselves known to me, it would take a lot of the stress of dating off my shoulders. I prided myself on how open-minded and not shallow I was. I knew that even if a girl who was not attractive by conventional standards approached me, I would more than likely be pretty enthusiastic about her. My wish came true one day during our lunch period when a girl I didn't recognize tapped me on the shoulder as I was taking a bite of some frozen cafeteria pizza. "Hey, you're Eric, right?" My reputation did not often precede me. I got nervous. "Yeah?" "Do you like white girls?" I froze to prevent myself from choking on frozen pizza. My interest in this girl increased with every word she spoke to me. I looked the girl up and down. I may have seen her around before, but I had no recollection of where or when. I found it odd, since our school was not that large, and I was remarkably good at remembering faces. She was bone thin, pale to the point of transparent, and had a face covered with acne. Her blonde hair was braided into two shoulder-length pigtails. She wasn't much to look at, but, as I said, my standards were fairly low at that point. I did find it strange that her pickup line was, "Hey, do you like white girls?" Although, perhaps I should have been more concerned. But I wanted a girlfriend desperately, so I rolled with it. "Yeah? Why?" I responded, suddenly feeling that I was more than likely the target of some cruel prank. "Cool," she said, "because my friend Tula likes you." Oh, thank goodness. As desperate as I was, I already didn't like the direction my relationship with pigtails was going. "Do you know Tula?" she continued. I shook my head. I wasn't aware anyone in our school was named Tula. Where are these people coming from? I was just hoping, whoever she was, that Pigtails here was her less attractive friend. Pigtails grabbed my arm and pulled me out of my seat. "Here, I'll show you." I feigned reluctance as she led me to the other side of the cafeteria. I wanted to push past her and run to the other side of the room shouting, "Which one is she? Show her to me!" This was already my fifth consecutive year wishing for a girlfriend. I was excited to finally save myself the guilt of lying to everyone when they asked what my New Year's resolution was. I could finally get over the anxiety of feeling completely unlovable. The fact that someone liked me from afar without me even realizing already bestowed on me a sense of validation. That it was possible for a lady person to be attracted to me. Perhaps I'm not destined for solitude after all. I'm sure Pigtails wasn't aware of how much she had just changed my life with our brief interaction, and I didn't want to overwhelm her, so I chose to play it cool. Our school's cafeteria was split into two segments, and through a doorway at the very edge of the room, you could see to the other side. Pigtails led me to the door and pointed toward one of the tables in the back of the room. I had no way of knowing exactly whom she was pointing at. All I saw was a long-haired figure turn in our direction, gasp in shock, and then dart dramatically underneath the table. "That must be Tula." Pigtails laughed. "That's Tula. She's kind of shy." I spent the rest of the day floating on a cloud. I had no idea what my secret admirer looked like, but it didn't matter, so long as I had one. I asked among my group of friends if any of them knew a Tula. No one did. What if she's a figment of my imagination? I was starting to believe that maybe I dreamt up the whole interaction. Maybe Pigtails doesn't even exist. It seemed likely. After all, I only knew her as Pigtails. Maybe she never had a real name to begin with. Maybe all of my obsession with having a girlfriend has finally driven me completely insane. By the end of the day, I was stressed, paranoid, and even more anxious than normal. Nevertheless, I held on to the hope that I wasn't going crazy. And there actually was a girl named Tula who went to our school who did in fact have a crush on me. I was on my way into my last class of the day when I was once again flagged down by a stranger. I looked her up and down. She was a short, stout girl with long brown hair. Her face was wide and flattened like it had been crushed by a giant nutcracker. Her hips were considerably wider than her shoulders, as if the top half of her body had melted down into her pelvis. She wore a black Hot Topic t-shirt displaying some band I didn't recognize, and a pair of ripped jeans. She stared up at me with two beady eyes caked with mascara, the only makeup she wore, aside from the black fingernail polish. I nearly jumped out of my skin when I saw her. "Hi, Eric," said the chubby goth before me. "I think my friend talked to you earlier. I'm Tula." If I were in a sitcom, I imagine I would have released a sigh of, "No," under my breath, like a balloon deflating. The "womp womp" trumpets would play in the background as the laugh track was cued. I was paralyzed with antipathy and disappointment. I had never before seen a girl I was more unattracted to. I wanted to say something to her, but the only thing I could think of was, "I've got to get out of here!" I just hoped more than anything else my true feelings were not visible on my face. After what seemed like minutes, I eventually managed to respond to her with a casual, "Hey," before bailing into my class. I think I handled that well. The rest of the day was spent spiraling into a self-inflicted depression. First, I thought maybe this was a big prank after all, and then I decided that this was my punishment from Karma herself. I had been selfishly wishing that a girlfriend would miraculously appear before me for 5 years. Maybe the powers that be were just sick of my whining, and they finally pulled the "be careful what you wish for" card on me. I had always praised myself for my open-mindedness, but now I saw myself becoming that which I swore to fight against, a shallow D-bag. Here was a girl that I'm sure was probably perfectly all right, but I wouldn't even give her a chance because of how she looked. I was sure this was some kind of test, and I was failing it big time. I was supposed to fall in love with this girl, despite her appearance, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I could barely look at her for a few seconds before wanting to turn away in repulsion. And so, I cursed the heavens for punishing me this way. "It's not fair," I thought. "I've been nothing but accepting. So what if I meet one girl I don't like? Why couldn't it be her friend? I don't think pigtails is all that attractive either, but I'd date her. I promise I would." And so it continued. I cycled through every stage of the Kubler-Ross model for grieving. But instead of hitting denial, anger, bargaining, and depression in sequence, all four emotions cycled through me at once. By the time I finally got to my version of acceptance, my most prominent feeling was disappointment in myself. Not knowing what else to do, I told my best friend Chris about the whole incident. He also had no idea who Tula was before I shared the story, and so we decided to do some research. Facebook didn't exist yet, so the only way to gather intel on our subject was to consult the school yearbook. I had been living outside of Chicago for the last 2 years, so Chris was the only one of the two of us who had one. And since we only had her first name to go off, we went through the book page by page looking for a Tula. "Wait," said Chris, "is that her?" He pointed out a photo of the nutcracker-faced girl who had accosted me the other day. She didn't look any more appealing in her glamour shot than she had when I met her in person. The photo was captioned with the first name, Tula. I took one glance at the photo, inhaled deeply, and nodded my head in affirmation. Chris took another look at the photo as well. "Wow," he said sympathetically. "Bummer, dude." I buried my face in my hands. "What am I supposed to do now, man?" To be fair, I didn't really know anything about the girl. What if she's a perfectly decent and compatible person? Looks shouldn't matter, right? Chris shrugged his shoulders. "I don't know, man. I don't think you have to do anything. Just avoid her." But what if she asks me out? Just tell her you're not interested. It all seemed so perfectly easy and logical. But Chris couldn't see the greater perspective in my mind. He wasn't taking into account just how desperately I wanted to have a girlfriend. He didn't consider how many compromises I was prepared to make. I sincerely believed that beggars cannot be choosers. So who was I to turn down Tula? To do so would make me a hypocrite, as far as I was concerned. But I ended up taking Chris's advice anyway, since it was probably what I would have ended up doing regardless. After all, it required me to do nothing and be invisible, which was always my preferred course of action in any situation. And so, for the next couple of weeks, things largely went back to normal. Of course, once you are made aware of a smudge on the painting of your life, it's almost impossible to unsee it. I had never noticed Tula or any of her friends at my school before. However, once I knew that she liked me, I seemed to see her everywhere. Walking through the halls, before school, by the bus stop, I felt as though she was present before and after each of my classes. I became paranoid I would see her at any moment. Luckily for me, she wasn't in any of my classes, nor did she share the same cafeteria as me during lunch. She also made no effort to reach out to me again. But I couldn't help but feel as if she was secretly stalking me. Overall, I would say Operation Just Ignore Her was working as intended, although I didn't anticipate how taxing the strategy would be. And just as I was beginning to believe I was in the clear, Tula's pigtailed friend cornered me once again. "Do you have ants in your pants?" she asked matter-of-factly as she passed me in the hallway. "What the hell does that even mean?" My anxiety and paranoia were immediately rekindled. I told Chris about this incident later that day. "What the heck does that even mean?" he asked. I shrugged. "You should give her a fake phone number or something," Chris suggested. "What? Why would I do that?" "To get her off your back. She'll leave you alone if she thinks she has your number. And if she actually calls, you'll never know." I thought about it a moment. I didn't like the idea, but at the same time, it seemed extremely practical. "I don't know," I said. "I don't want to piss her off." Chris shrugged. We were in agreement that it wasn't the most ethical plan, but neither of us could think of anything more reasonable to do. Another few days passed. Chris and I were on our way to lunch when a familiar pigtail-headed apparition appeared before us. "Hey, have you talked to Tula yet?" I wanted to hide behind Chris, and so I did. "Will you leave him alone already?" said my less pathetic friend. "She's not going to bite you," said Pigtails, addressing the husk of a person behind Chris. "Fine. You know what?" Chris pulled out a sheet of paper and a pen from his bag and jotted down a phone number I recognized. It was the first three digits of my phone number, combined with the last four of his own. I had no idea to whom such a call would be directed. I gestured for Chris to stop. "Hey, Chris, wait." But the scrap of paper was already in Pigtails' clutches, and she was back on her way down the hall. In retrospect, the fact that I motioned to stop Chris probably indicated to Pigtails that the number was accurate. That, in the moment, I was embarrassed about Chris giving away my actual number. What can I say? I'm one hell of an actor when I don't mean to be. As much as I regretted giving Tula a fake phone number, Chris was right about it giving me some peace of mind. I didn't see her much around the school after that day, and when I did, I didn't feel anxious or uncomfortable. Nevertheless, I was afraid that Tula actually tried to call the number and realized it was fake. She must hate me. Although, I guess I'd rather that than her liking me. But it wasn't over between Tula and I yet. The final straw actualized when the annual county fair came to town. It was basically tradition that we all go to the fair at least once, because it was the only time there were roller coasters and other rides anywhere close to us. And so Chris and I went during the weekend. We were super pumped because it was the first time we were allowed to go together without parental supervision. Naturally, we ran into a bunch of our other friends from school. There was really nothing else a group of teenagers could do together on the weekend in our town, so everyone we knew was there. And not long after enjoying some of our favorite rides did Chris and I see Tula and her friend Pigtails. "Crap, look who's here," I said, nodding subtly in Tula's direction. "Aw, man," said Chris. "Hurry, let's get on the Ferris wheel." We slinked away into the Ferris wheel line, careful to avoid Tula's line of sight. "You think she saw us?" I asked as we boarded one of the carriages. "I hope not." But as the gate closed behind us, there in line was Tula and Pigtails. I might have hoped that this was a coincidence, but they were staring directly at us. Pigtails gave us an enthusiastic wave. Chris and I wrenched our heads away and locked eyes on each other. I went white. "We're trapped," I cried. And off we went, looping our way up to the top of the wheel. As we neared the top, Chris ventured a glance over the side of the ride. "It's all right," he said. "They're getting on." "How is that a good thing?" "It means they'll still be on it when we get off. Let's just book it to the other side of the park." I might have realized this myself if I hadn't been so busy panicking. I praised Chris for his quick thinking. And so once the ride came to a stop and we were let out of the carriage, we made a break for the other end of the park, weaving through the carnival games and ticket booths. Naturally, we didn't want to draw attention to ourselves and go at an all-out sprint. Instead, we jogged away, making sure to look as if we were excited to get on the next ride, rather than running away in fear. The next hour or so was spent the same way, dipping and running away from Tula and Pigtails as they chased us across the fair. I couldn't help but think of it as some epic game of doubles tag. I imagined in my head that Tula was having as much fun with it as I was. Eventually, Chris and I lost our pursuers, and once again lined up to get on the next carnival ride. Just ahead of us in line was another girl from our class named Wendy. Wendy, Chris, and I had all known each other since elementary school. We were not the closest friends, but we knew each other well. After I moved back to my hometown from Chicago, I had developed a huge crush on Wendy. I debated calling out to her, but suddenly felt embarrassed. And then I felt uncomfortable that I felt embarrassed. And then a wave of guilt hit me. Hard. I thought back to every single girl I had ever had a crush on in the past. I remember how stressful and frustrating it was trying to ask them out, let alone have a normal conversation with them. Just saying hello was a huge victory for me. I thought about how dejected I felt when they seemed to ignore my interest in them. I thought about how desperately I wanted them to just be honest with me and tell me how they felt. I sighed deeply, realizing that I had fully become what I had been trying to avoid all this time. A hypocrite. I thought it would be so nice to have all the power. To have someone place their heart on a plate and present it for you to embrace or crush between your fingers. And now, when the tables were turned, I realized that I had done nothing to soothe the bleeding. This little run around the fair was surely just as vicious a punishment for Tula's honesty as I had faced countless times in the past. It did not feel so good to be the villain in someone else's story. I held my head in my hands. I'm such a jerk. I didn't see Tula the rest of the day, nor did I see her much in school after that. I assume she got my message loud and clear. I was not interested. And there was no worse way to deliver such a message than to literally run away from her affections. I went over the events in my head several times and continued to shame myself for my actions. I tried to think of alternatives to my behavior. What could I have said or done differently? And as much as I replayed the scenarios in my head, I couldn't think of one that didn't make me seem insensitive, arrogant, or rude. Maybe I should have just lied to her and said I had a girlfriend or wasn't interested in dating. But no greater level of dishonesty exists in this world. And I didn't want to become a jerk and a liar. After my experience with Tula, I vowed never to stomp on someone else's heart ever again. I swore to be kind and to be honest. Although, since I have never been tested in such a way again, I fear that I may not have matured at all since the 8th grade. The story ends there. There's a whole lot going on in this one, and I'm looking forward to breaking it down for you guys next week. Make sure you send me your thoughts about the story if there's anything in particular you want me to touch on. Until then, have a lovely week, and I'll see you on Monday to talk more about my experience with Tula. But that's it for this episode of Romeo And. As always, if you have a story you want featured on the podcast, send me a message via email, contact@stsaint.com, or give me a call at 516-514-7878. Also, be sure to follow me on social media, like Romeo And on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter @street_saint. New episodes of Romeo And are published weekly, so make sure you get every episode when it's released by subscribing to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcatcher of your choice. But if you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and Stitcher and give us a 5-star rating. There's nothing more valuable for the show than getting a bunch of good ratings from all of you guys. So thanks again for listening. I am Street Saint, and I'll see you next time.